Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, November 18th, 2013. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on the first and third Monday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on prn.fm and drsaputo.com.
Today you will hear Nurse Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that's going to include important tips for when a parent or a loved one is dying.
And what could be good about having breast cancer?
Boy, that's a good one, huh? And what about the most commonly prescribed pain medicine for pregnant women that can harm her baby?
Why a nurturing parent is important for children's brain development.
And what do you think influences your order in a restaurant the most? That one's going to surprise you.
You know, if we're fortunate enough to have our parents until old age, we need to be prepared when that end is in sight. And it isn't an emotional time, and not all families agree or even get along. So you need to be sure to ask your mom and your dad or your grandparents, whoever it is, that you need to ask them their end-of-life wishes ahead of time and have them do the proper paperwork. There's something called an advance directive or a living will. And to do this with a chosen health advocate and a durable power of attorney for healthcare to make these decisions for them when they can't. And it's important to honor our parents' wishes.
Well, it is. And these are things that sometimes you can't do because things are so sudden, particularly if it's someone who dies at an early age. But we should be thinking about that because we have a lot of things to manage at end of life. And a lot of the time we do have that information and we have time to prepare.
But you might not even agree with it when the time comes, you know, and mm-hmm. you have to honor what that person said that they want.
Well, especially in a big family. What happens if you have a lot of brothers and sisters? I mean, there you've got different opinions sometimes.
And not all families agree.
No.
And not all families get along. But you need to have your parent sign these forms ahead of time so that it's there and that it's clear. But you don't want at the end to be feeling guilty, like, did I do the right thing?
Right.
Or would they have really wanted this or that? Or, you know, that sort of a thing. But there's going to be a lot of paperwork and a lot of decisions and a lot of meetings and a lot of emotions of sadness and fear and grief and other emotions. And many times the hospital will have people call you, like social workers and case management and palliative care, and the list goes on. Mm-hmm. And they'll be calling you about plans for moving him or her to another facility.
Yeah, they're in
so
the hospital, right.
So it's helpful to be thinking of this and look into it ahead of time before you're under a lot of stress and a lot of pressure. And many times these people are on a time crunch because the hospital wants to get them out of there and get them someplace else. Mm-hmm. And they might not even be polite to you because they're in a hurry and they want to get it done. So this is another reason why it's good to get it thought through ahead of time.
Well, I think there are a lot of things that you need to think about specifically, like, do you want to use dialysis or breathing machines? Do you want to be resuscitated if your breathing or heartbeat stops? Do you want to be fed by a tube? What are you going to do with organ or tissue donation? All these questions will come up. And if you haven't thought about it, all of a sudden the weight of the world is on you. And keep in mind that every family has its dysfunctional nature because we all have our challenges in life. So when we get to a place where we're having to make decisions, and they're group decisions, and they're different people who've had different experiences because they're just different in the family, it takes some consensus. And if you haven't had a good life, a good, really functional life in your early years, that's going to come back and bite you in your later years. There's a lot that has to do with the relationships that we have with our brothers and sisters in our family that come out at end of life.
And this is a time, if you can, to try to set that aside and have it be about the parent.
Mm-hmm.
This is about the parent and about their comfort.
Think about how it could be, Vicki, if a parent is an alcoholic and they've abused a kid. Say it's a father. And there was incest and there were problems with physical abuse and emotional abuse. How do you think that one's going to go? Talk about a challenging situation. And we see a lot of this. I know in my practice, when someone comes to see me for their health issues, we're always going back to childhood stuff. What happened? How did you get so that you had the certain kinds of fears that you have and the problems that you experienced as a child that are still there today and still haunting you because you haven't worked through it? Maybe you can't sleep, or maybe there's a lot of stress, or maybe you're depressed, and it may link back to experiences like that.
Well, I know someone, Ashley, that's going through this right now with a step-parent,
mm-hmm.
and she's just amazing because she's able to take care of his, all the paperwork, that sort of thing. She's doing all that mm-hmm. for him, but I know has to be extremely difficult.
Well, a lot of it's being done for yourself, too, because a lot of the time there's an estate involved, and there can be money involved. And maybe not everybody's being treated the same way. And so one child has a different relationship than another child does with either parent.
And then there's jealousy and sibling rivalry and all those sort of things. Another thing that I wanted to bring up here is that, have you been able to bring yourself to plan for which mortuary or cemetery to use? That's a good thing to have in a file someplace for when the time comes.
Well, how do you want to be disposed of, if you want to look at it that way?
You
want to be cremated? Do you want to be embalmed? Do you want to have your ashes spread? And if so, how are you going to do that? Is it a practical thing to do? I mean, not everybody's going to put somebody's ashes in an urn and fly over some area of the world and spread their ashes. It's just not going to happen to everybody.
Well, also, I think it's important to think about the person's spiritual needs.
Mm.
And if you're uncomfortable talking to your parent about that, you mm-hmm. can call in pastoral care.
Mm-hmm.
I know hospice offers that also.
Right.
And different churches offer that, so you could have somebody come in and talk to them about that, because this is the time to do it.
You know what I've experienced as a doctor, Vicki, over the last half century almost, is that it's different for every person when they're dying. A lot of people, they die alone. They die in the hospital. They die in the intensive care unit or the coronary care unit or some specialized unit, and they're alone. There's no family there. Or they may come just sparingly. And in situations like that, it's really tough to die. And dying should be a sacred transition, a sacred passage from one realm to another.
When I was with my dad while he was dying, I knew that he didn't want to be alone. And I knew that he was afraid of it because he had said that beforehand.
Well, it wasn't just that. I mean, what you did as a child for your parent was unbelievable. And he died with people all over the place, and it was at home. And he had the best care he could possibly have, and the services that hospice provided were extraordinary.
Well, see, what happens sometimes is people just don't go visit them and leave them there when they get Alzheimer's
right.
or some sort of dementia
right.
because they say, well, they don't remember me. They don't know who I am. But you need to stop and think, what is this about? Is this about me or is this about them?
Well, it's about both,
and
actually.
And also, but listen to me. Also, if you really love somebody, mm-hmm. you want to be there with them.
Uh-huh.
You want to be with them as much as you can because uh-huh. they're going to be gone and you can't do it again.
Uh-huh. Well,
and
that's true.
And that's love, you know? So if you really do love somebody, I think you need to ask yourself these questions.
You know, the story of your father's death, I thought, was one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. Tell us a little bit about how that happened. What was that experience like?
Well, yeah, you mean the last day?
No, leading up to it.
Well, just that I spent a lot of time. First of all, when he was in the hospital before he came home,
mm-hmm.
We didn't want to leave him alone. So uh-huh. we had it figured out so somebody from the family uh-huh. was in the room at all times.
Right.
And we had a cot in the room
mm-hmm.
so that we could always be with him.
Uh-huh.
And then when we got home, we also had a cot and we had a hospital bed in the family room, which was the perfect place because uh-huh. it wasn't like he was shoved away in some room someplace.
He was right in the center of everything.
Everything that was going on, and we were with him, and
uh-huh.
and that was what he wanted. He was so afraid of the whole thing, and
yeah.
he wanted to be home. He really wanted to be home. And then when the end got near, I just slept on a cot right next to him, mm-hmm. All the, you know, every night. And I was always touching him and holding his hand.
Did you put a little bell on him somewhere so you could hear where he, where
oh,
he was?
That was
he was
before, well, that was before the very end. Well, that was toward the end before he was unconscious. But yeah, he would try to get out of bed and then he would fall down. So I put his old Santa Claus jingle bell on the, walker. Uh-huh. And I was sleeping in the room right next to where my parents were. And so when I'd hear the bell, I knew he was trying to get up.
Right.
So I'd run in there and then I'd help him. But, we did call hospice in at the end, mm-hmm. but it was still difficult for me because I was so worried. Uh-huh. And I wanted to be with him when it happened. And so even when they were there, I still didn't sleep well and kept getting up.
But, how valuable was hospice for you?
Well, it was helpful to know that I had the support of somebody to help me like that. Uh-huh. Because toward the end, the rest of my family got pretty burned out.
Yeah, it's hard, particularly when it's a long time. It was weeks.
And I know that. Well, that's where the topic of caretakers comes up too. Mm-hmm. But anyway, when he died, he was in my arms and we were all surrounding him, and it was ended up being a very spiritual, beautiful experiences.
Uh-huh.
But there's more things that
tell us more about that. That was a very interesting time. What happened in that experience?
Well,
there were probably 10 people around the bedside.
Yeah, well, I knew that he was going to die that day because I'd been monitoring him so carefully, and his vital signs kept decreasing. You know, mm-hmm. his blood pressure kept getting lower. So I called everybody and told them that if they wanted to be with him before he died, that this was the time. And so there were probably, well, my two sons, my nephew.
About 10 people.
You, my mom, mm-hmm. my other friend. So that's how many were there. And we were all with him. And then I was just sitting on the edge of the bed, and I could see that everything was getting slower.
Uh-huh.
And I reached down. I was going to move him, and he gasped, and he almost sat up and opened his eyes wide and looked right at me, and that was his last breath in my arms.
Right.
And so when I was a child, he had taught me a prayer of, "Now I lay me down to sleep," and it just came out of my mouth. And I felt like it was so perfect. I couldn't have planned it better. "Now I lay me down to sleep. Mm-hmm. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. Uh-huh. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take."
And that is what seemed like it happened. Because what followed that?
Well, then my son Sean, we had been reading books about out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences and things. And he looked up at the ceiling and started waving. And he says, "Bye, Popo.
Right.
Bye, Popo." And then everybody else started waving up at toward the ceiling, you know, "Goodbye, Johnny. Goodbye, Dad. Goodbye," everything.
Right.
And then we sort of settled down. And then Sean said he felt a breeze at the head of the bed.
It was a cool breeze.
So we got up and we all went over there and we could feel this cool breeze at the head. And there was no vent in that room. This was our family room that had radiant heating. Mm-hmm. So the windows weren't open. There was no fan. There was nothing. And
so
we,
where does a breeze come from that's cold?
Yeah, that was...
Yeah, that
I mean,
was
we had a lot of ideas about what that probably was, but it felt like a very spiritual, holy experience that was filled with grace. And so that's why I felt that it was such a positive experience.
Well, it was a beautiful thing to see everybody coming together and looking at what we needed to do that would help him make that transition as peacefully and with as little fear as possible. And I think you accomplished that, Vicki. That was wonderful.
So back to caring for your elderly parent. when nurses care for your parent, it's a good idea to check on what they're doing. Like if they say that they want to pull the curtain and they want to, you know, check your mom or your dad or what have you, say that you want to be in there and observe too. And then you can look and see if there's bed sores or what their skin looks like or what's really going on, you know. And
a lot of things don't go right in the hospital. And particularly if it's end of life and it's really supportive, just comfort care, a lot of things don't get tended to. And these are things that you can observe and make decisions about, particularly if you have medical authority to be able to make those
decisions.
Well,
many people say that they don't know what to do when they're with them. They just don't know. They feel awkward, you know. And my being a nurse, it's easy for me, but I can also give people suggestions.
It would have been easy for you anyway because of your nature, because you're there, present, and involved. And, of course, having your nursing skills adds to that, so it's a big advantage. But that's who you are.
Well, I keep thinking all the time, and I bring supplies, like when with my mom. Mm-hmm. My mom's 97, and I brought some lotion, and mm-hmm. I massaged her face, like giving her a facial, and brushed her teeth, and put lotion on her arms, and massaged her hands.
When
and
I
her
saw
legs,
her last night, she looked wonderful, and she's certainly end of life right now.
Yeah, and I massaged her feet, put lipstick on her, you know, combed her hair.
Well, I hope I go first, Vicky. I want you to be there.
But she kept smiling, you know. But it's nice to just the touch. And then, like a lot of elderly people get cold at the end.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're cold all the time because they're not exercising.
Well,
they've lost a lot of weight.
They can't make energy and it can't produce
heat. So we have
heat.
This warm beanbag and we put it in the microwave and she just loves that.
Right.
Loves that. And also remember that a lot of them can't hear very well, so they need some sort of a hearing device.
Right. Yeah.
But it's about comfort and it's about quality of life. And once it gets to that point, it's not about the length and making them live longer. It's about making them comfortable and feeling as good as they want. You need to find out if they want visitors or if they want to be left alone.
Well, all those things are important. But think of something, Vicky. You know, Jean Shinoda Bolen wrote a book called Close to the Bone. And the essence of that book, in my opinion, was that when we get to our end of life or someone we love is near the end of life, our values shift. It's no longer about our bank account or how much property we own or the assets that we have. It's about relationships. And we try to make amends for that. Even the Martins and the McCoys, you know, when they're on the deathbed, the values change. And we try to do things that support one another and to make amends, because that's what we miss in our life and what we get away from. We get all caught up with how much money and power do we have? How much stuff do we have? And we forget about why we're here. It's to experience and exchange relationships with all that there is. Because when you look at the senses we have, they're all designed for what? For communication.
It's also about unconditional love.
Yeah, that happens even in situations where there's a lot of hostility and anger and things that haven't worked out. There's still that connection, that tie that's deep, that brings us together at times like that. And those are the things that we should be focusing on, of course, through our life. We shouldn't be waiting until there's some imminent disaster that's coming up.
So plan ahead for a smooth and a loving spiritual transition.
Absolutely. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicky. And it's time for Vicky's first 2020 tip on, am I a fireman yet? That sounds like me when I was a kid. And when we come back, we'll be talking about what could be good about having breast cancer.
Am I a fireman yet? This is a true story, and you might want to go get your box of Kleenex. It happened in Calgary, Alberta, to a 6-year-old boy that was dying of terminal leukemia. And his 26-year-old mother, obviously, her heart was filled with sadness, and she also had a strong feeling of determination. And like any parent, she wanted her son to grow up and fulfill all his dreams. And now she felt that it was no longer possible and that the leukemia was going to take care of that. But she still wanted her son's dream to come true. So she took her son's hand and she asked him if he ever thought about what he wanted to be when he grew up, and did he ever dream and wish what he would do with his life? And he says, Mommy, I always wanted to be a fireman when I grew up. So she smiled and she said, well, let's see if we can make your wish come true. And so later that day, she went to her local fire department in Calgary, where she met with Fireman Bob, who had a heart as big as Alberta. And she explained her son's final wish and asked if it might be possible to give her 6-year-old son a ride around the block on a fire engine. And Fireman Bob said, look, we can do better than that. If you'll have your son ready ready at 7 o'clock Wednesday morning, we'll make him an honorary fireman for the whole day. Okay. He can come down to the fire station, eat with us, go out on all the fire calls, the whole nine yards. And if you'll give us his sizes, we'll get a real fire uniform for him with a real fire hat, not a toy, one with the emblem of the Calgary Fire Department on it, and a yellow slicker like we wear, and rubber boots. They're all manufactured right here in Calgary, so we can get them fast. So 3 days later, Fireman Bob picks up Billy, dressed him in his uniform, and escorted him from his hospital bed to the waiting hook and ladder truck. And Billy got to sit on the back of the truck and help steer it back to the fire station. It was heaven. There were three fire calls in Calgary that day, and Billy got to go out on all three calls. And he rode in the different fire engines, the paramedics van, and even the fire chief's car. He was also videotaped for the local news program, which is probably why I have this story. Having his dream come true with all the love and attention that was lavished on him so deeply touched Billy that he lived 3 months longer than any doctor thought possible. And one night, all of his vital signs did begin to drop dramatically, and the head nurse who believed in the hospice concept that no one should die alone, she started calling the family members to the hospital. And then she remembered the day that Billy had spent as a fireman. So she called the fire chief and she asked if it would be possible to send a fireman in uniform to the hospital to be with Billy as he made his transition. And the chief replied, "We can do better than that. We'll be there in 5 minutes. Will you please do me a favor? When you hear the sirens screaming and see the lights flashing, will you announce over the PA system that there is not a fire? It's the department coming to see one of its finest members one more time. And will you open the window to his room?" Oh, about 5 minutes later, a hook and ladder truck arrived at the hospital and extended its ladder up to Billy's third floor open window. 16 firefighters climbed up the ladder into Billy's room. And with his mother's permission, they hugged him and held him and told him how much they loved him. And with his dying breath, Billy looked up at the fire chief and he said, "Chief, am I really a fireman now?" And the chief said, "Billy, you are, and the head chief, Jesus, is holding your hand." Well, with those words, Billy smiled and he said, "I know. He's been holding my hand all day, and the angels have been singing." And he closed his eyes one last time.
Wow. Where's my hanky? Wow.
Well, death happens not just to the old and the dying. It can happen to any of us. And I think that they always say that there's nothing worse than losing a child, and thank God I have not had to experience that.
What a beautiful story. Those are the kinds of things that we should be paying more attention to rather than all the things that distract us from what life is about. Yeah, thanks for the hanky. It's about relationships. It's about caring, listening and caring and supporting and loving and being with and trying to make somebody else happy. You know, the concept we have of love when we're first dating and everything is feeling exciting and we're into how we feel. We learn fairly quickly that, yeah, that's important and it does feel good, but it's not about us. The relationships in life that really matter are the ones about making somebody else happy. And that's what this story is about. And it's about what the next story in part is going to be about as well.
Well, of course, nobody wants breast cancer.
No.
And there's a lot of fear surrounding it. It's a dreaded diagnosis. And when you take into account the body, mind, emotion, spirit connection, it's actually not all bad. And for many people, it's a time for emotional and spiritual growth, like we were talking about earlier, and a time to learn who your real friends are. And really, who you are.
For sure.
And there was a study, obviously, we always report on studies here, mm-hmm. on positive personal growth following a breast cancer diagnosis.
Right.
But I think this goes for other types of cancer diagnoses
or any kind of any serious illness.
Yes,
yeah,
terminal
that's
illness.
Right.
Shows that there can be some unexpected benefits. And since we know the downsides, let's talk about some of the positive outcomes following a diagnosis like breast cancer.
Well, that's really right. You know, we tend to appreciate the things we take for granted the most when there's a threat of loss. And that's what happens in these situations where death's door is being opened and we're looking to pass through it. suddenly we wake up. It's like we're being reborn, reincarnated, and get a view of what life is about.
Well, when people hear the big C, you know, that's usually what comes
that's
to their
panic.
Mind first.
Yeah, that's panic.
It doesn't mean that they're going to die from this or right away or anything, but sometimes they do.
Well, it shows how life can take us out of the present tense. It can make us worry about what's going to happen, make us think about the losses that we're going to incur, and it keeps us from living and feeling the intensity of life in a positive way.
Well, tell an example. I know that you had a patient, Julie, a few years ago, and tell us the story about her.
I've had a lot of patients who have died, and I've become more of an expert in how to counsel people through that. And it's like what this study that was published in the journal called Psycho-Oncology in October of 2013 on 653 women who were really getting something that was called a change from post-traumatic growth, meaning that they were shattered by something that happened to them, like a diagnosis of breast cancer. And then they followed them over a couple of years to see what the outcome was. And a lot of things happened, like with what you were just brought up with this person, Julie. It was my patient. She was somebody that came to me at age 39 with far advanced breast cancer. This was several years ago. And she's now gone. And she came when she had horrible pain. She had heard that we had the infrared light therapy and wondered if maybe we could help get her out of pain because she was really on morphine at the time and needed some kind of relief. And as magic would happen, within 5 minutes, most of her pain was gone. I couldn't believe it myself.
But the thing that was most important was the relationship that you built with her.
Oh, for sure. And I'm only getting to that. I mean, here we have a situation that kind of brought us together, and we were able to control her pain. And, you know, just 5 minutes of treatment, she was good for months, you know, weeks to months of no pain. She wouldn't have to take anything for it. And during that time, we developed a close relationship where we were looking at what was happening to her and what are the values that are important. And she knew this. What was really interesting about her is she didn't have much money. Her husband didn't have a job that made a lot of money. Their insurance wasn't that good. And it was a privilege for me to just be there in support and say, okay, don't worry about the money. She had a big fundraising party that a lot of people came to. Remember?
Oh, yeah, we
went
invited.
To that.
Yeah.
And so what we donated was free health care to her for the rest of her life and just accepted assignment on whatever insurance might pay. And to see how she glowed as she connected with people and was so appreciative of the things they did for her. And her children were there. She had two little kids.
Daughters.
Two little daughters, 7 or 8 years old, who she knew she was going to leave. And the way she was with them and the way her husband handled that and the way her friend supported her made this an experience that was a beautiful thing to go through, a privilege to be honored, respected, cared for, loved, listened to. Was really a wonderful thing.
So this is where we're talking about some of the positive things that go with this diagnosis. I've talked to other people, too, that have had this cancer diagnosis, and they talk about how it's enhanced their interpersonal relationships, mm-hmm. and it's increased their appreciation for life and given them more of a personal strength and more connection to spirit and to focus more on their priorities and their goals in life and a lot of the support that people get with these support groups, but mm-hmm. even just social support and family support and all that sort of thing makes a person really feel loved and helps them to cope and helps them with their fear and seems to promote a positive attitude that they found in this study that was actually unrelated to optimism in general. So people that are, it's not related to whether a person's an optimist or not. It's just promotes this positive attitude. And the social support contributes to the post-traumatic growth.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole study and topic is really comes down to encouraging doctors and other healthcare practitioners to do what you're always talking about, to listen, because it really is beneficial for people that have these types of diagnoses.
It's why we do things called a healing circle, Vicki, where we'll bring people together, four or five of them, to spend time, 2 hours with patients who are having a hard time, and just be with them after they've written an autobiography of what their situation's like.
And it's so important to reach out when a family or a friend gets this diagnosis.
Absolutely. Well, it's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio. I'll be talking about what's the most commonly prescribed pain medicine for pregnant women that could actually harm their baby. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki.
We all know that moms, pregnant moms, want to have a healthy baby more than anything in the world.
That could be worse than having a baby with a major genetic defect of some kind. It can be a huge issue.
And we all know that it's best for pregnant moms to avoid medicine if possible because it could harm her baby. And yes, even Tylenol, acetaminophen,
right,
the pain medicine that's most prescribed by doctors for pregnant women because it can adversely affect her unborn baby. Now, studies have already shown that it can cause liver problems and hearing loss and gastrointestinal bleeding. Mm-hmm. What did they find in this new Norwegian study?
Okay, this was a study that was published by the Norwegian Institute of Public Health. And they did a study that was called the Norwegian Mother and Child Cohort Study. It was published in the International Journal of Epidemiology in October of 2013. And what they did is they followed kids whose mothers had been on Tylenol for more than 28 days during their pregnancy. And what they found is that they had poorer gross motor skills, so their coordination wasn't very good. Their communication skills were retarded. They had more behavioral problems. And they even found that if women took Tylenol for less than 28 days, that there was a trend for them too, even though it was quite a bit weaker. So what we have here is a wake-up call. What can you give to a pregnant woman that's safe? In fact, what can you give to anybody? Would you really want to give even Tylenol to people in the hospital?
And I think that women, if they look back on it after they have a child that maybe has been affected by the Tylenol, that has a bad temperament, and they have these problems with their brain development and everything.
Maybe they get diagnosed as ADD.
Yeah, and they look back over it, and they find out that it was from the acetaminophen.
Mm-hmm.
I'll bet you that all those moms would say, I would have rather had a headache for a month, because it says 28 days, which is like a month.
Well, the sad part about that is there are a lot of ways to control pain that don't involve doing things to set the biochemistry of the body.
All the time.
Oh, sure. I mean, do acupuncture, do chiropractic. These are non-invasive things. Try a little homeopathy.
Massage, ice.
Sure, infrared light therapy. There's so many things that you can do to manage pain that are safe rather than, it just bugs me when I see the ads on TV and say that Tylenol is a pain medication that doctors recommend most.
Yeah, because a doctor prescribes it doesn't make it safe or a good idea.
Well,
doctors prescribe all these other medicines that we talk about in so many other shows about, and they're the things that cause thousands and hundreds of thousands of deaths.
Oh, well, I mean, just look at the NSAIDs, things like ibuprofen and Celebrex and Vioxx. I mean, all these things that have been out there for a number of years. And look at the problems it's leading to. 30,000 deaths a year, increased risks of heart attack and strokes. Another 50,000 people died just from the use of Vioxx over about 5 years.
And then all these ads we see showing babies and the mothers giving their small children these drugs because it's such a loving atmosphere when they're showing it. It's like, oh,
well,
brother,
they're trying to brainwash you into buying their product so they can make more money. It's not so much about trying to provide
like
a service.
Like it's this nurturing, loving thing to give your baby some medicine, you know. I can still remember when Shia was a baby and she had an ear infection, an earache that... And so we just put some warm drops with olive oil and a little tiny bit of garlic and I'll think of it later.
Okay. All right.
Anyway, in her ear and put heat on it. And I just held her on my lap with that warm compress on it.
97% of the infections that kids get are infections that are viral. They're not bacterial. And antibiotics don't do any good against the virus. And they cause a lot of harm to the natural microflora of the body in every area where that antibiotic goes.
And you see, too, nurturing is so important.
For sure.
But in this day and age when everybody's in this fast track, you know, yeah, and they don't have time, and so give them some medicine and it'll shut them up.
Yeah. Well, that's really true. You know, we got to go a little bit deeper than that.
But we're talking about pregnant women taking it and affecting their unborn fetus.
Well, you could say that there are problems with people that aren't pregnant, too, because look at the things that Tylenol can do. It's actually a very dangerous drug. If you take 15 grams, okay, which isn't that much, that's probably a bottle of Tylenol, you can kiss your liver goodbye. You'll wind up either with a liver transplant or a death from liver toxicity. And let me tell you, if you want to commit suicide, that ain't the way to do it, because you will suffer for weeks to months with that problem a lot of the time.
And what people don't realize many times is that Tylenol is an ingredient in many cold medicines.
And it still
builds up. And cough medicines.
Well, you can OD on it pretty easily. And what about the hearing problems? You know, if you take these, if you take Tylenol for a long period of time, the risk for developing loss of hearing is probably close to 10%. I mean, I'll bet 25% of the population has a problem with hearing, and a lot of it's caused by what? Drugs that we use, a lot of antibiotics.
What did you say?
Drugs that, you got me to hook on that one. That's great. So we should really be respectful of the power of medications, not just from the point of view of what they do that's good, but from the potential of what they can do that's harmful. And we are taught as doctors right off the bat about pharmacology as the big thing. And that's what we do. We're doctors of medicine and surgery. And I mean medicine in the sense of drugs. And that's what we depend on. And that's not all bad. That can be wonderful. But it ain't the first cab off the rank. It's not the first way to go. It's the last way to go. We should always be looking at the safer things that we can do first. Lifestyle medicine. We're always talking about lifestyle medicine. Do that first. Give this everything that you can do from living with a healthy lifestyle. And like we're always saying, it's the most powerful medicine in the universe. So if you want to be well,
pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Yeah, we said that about 2,000 times. And it's true. And I think that's what we have to do, rather than be thinking of doing things that are aggressive, that are dangerous. You know, if lifestyle doesn't work, use a non-invasive therapy. You know, think of chiropractic or Chinese medicine or some other form of healthcare, of which there are hundreds of different ways to go. If that doesn't work, then you should turn to nutritional biochemistry. You know, think about supplements and herbs and things that maybe there are 40 or 50 deaths a year from, the 400,000 that we see from drugs.
But I don't know if herbs are even such a great idea when you're pregnant. I think
they're
that
not.
The fewer
Nothing
things you do when you're
idea.
Pregnant, that it's better to not do anything.
But look at the difference in the danger of supplements and herbs and medications. Now you're looking at numbers that are so far different. When you're looking at 400,000 deaths a year from medicines in the U.S. alone, that's a staggering number. When you're looking at deaths from supplements and herbs, you're looking at maybe 50 deaths, and probably none every year from vitamins, one every 2 or 3 years in the whole country. And we think that that's not good science, so we can't be doing that. Don't give me that. When we know we've got something that actually works, that's far safer than what we depend on, because that's the way we learn things in medical training. And, of course, Big Pharma's right there behind supporting it, because that's how they make their income.
So if you're pregnant and you want to have a healthy baby and you want their development to be normal, you better think twice about taking Tylenol, acetaminophen, or any other kind of drug, and see if you can maybe try some alternative therapies like we mentioned earlier.
Just because the ads are good and try to convince you that doctors recommend Tylenol first and it's the most common drug that they prescribe doesn't mean that it's necessarily a safe thing to do.
And this is why it's important to learn a lot of the things that we talk about on this show so that you can partner with your doctor and you can make some
Take
of your
some
own.
Take some responsibility yourself.
Make your
Guide
own decisions.
Guide your doctor to what's the safest thing you can do.
Yeah.
All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on a bus stop quiz. You come up with the weirdest things, but they're wonderful. And when we come back, we'll be talking about why a nurturing parent is important for a children's brain development and what influences you the most when you order in the restaurant.
You're driving down the road in your Corvette on a wild, stormy night when you pass by a bus stop and you see three people waiting for the bus. An old lady who looks as if she's about to die, an old friend who once saved your life, and the perfect partner you've been dreaming about. Which one would you choose to offer a ride to, knowing that there could only be one passenger in your car? So think before I continue. This is a moral ethical dilemma that was once actually used as a part of a job application. You could pick up the old lady because she's going to die, and thus you should save her first. Or you could take the old friend because he once saved your life, and this would be the perfect chance to pay him back. However, you may never be able to find your perfect mate again. Well, the candidate who was hired out of 200 applicants didn't have any trouble coming up with his answer.
Really?
He just simply answered, "I'd give the car keys to my old friend and let him take the old lady to the hospital, and then I'd stay behind and wait for the bus with the partner of my dreams."
Ah, think outside the box, huh?
You know, sometimes we gain more if we're able to give up our stubborn thought limitations.
Yeah, indeed. That's great.
Yeah, never forget to think outside the box.
Right.
You know, poor parents are often under stress, and they're less capable of giving their children the nurturing that they need. And this can result in negative brain changes in their children, like learning disabilities and depression and ADHD, and the inability to cope with stress themselves. So nurturing is very important, and it can affect cognitive, developmental, and emotional states. You know, this is as bad as medicine side effects, you know, like the Tylenol we were just talking about.
Right. Well, there was a study that was done that looked at this. It was published in the journal called Pediatrics in October of 2013 by the Washington University School of Medicine. And what they looked at was 145 kids aged 6 to 12 years old and did MRIs on them as part of this research study. And what they did is, this is really cute the way they put this study together. They gave their mother an appointment, and the kid was supposed to come with her. And the child was given a present, told not to open it until the mother filled out the forms. So you can see there's trouble already, because what do you think the child's going to want to do?
Open the present.
You open the present.
And interrupt the mom, and
exactly.
She can't concentrate to fill out the forms.
Right. So the test then is really a measurement of how patient is the kid and how patient is the mother. How much nurturing did the mother give in that setting? And what they found is that they test worse if the parent is poor, is under a lot of stress. And the question is what is it? Is it diet or stress or intrauterine factors or just opportunity? Is it poor education? Is it parent nurturing? Is it environmental toxins? What is it?
So why do you think it's worse with the poor?
Well, I think that there is a lot more stress in poor people, a lot of financial issues, a lot of challenges that other people don't have because they're living in areas where there's not much opportunity and all the factors that we talked about.
And they might have more than one job, too.
Oh, sure. And in this particular study, they looked at the effect of nurturing. And it made a big difference because these kids who were pestering mom and mom was not being very nurturing – in general, had smaller amygdalas, which is the emotional center of the brain, and a smaller hippocampus, which is really involved with thinking and concentration.
And it also affected the white and the gray matter, too, of the brain, right?
Well, that's right. There was a lot less of it. So what we have here is an environmental factor that has a huge effect on how the brain will function, how it will develop.
Well, how a child's treated really can affect their self-confidence and their ability to learn. And if the mom is depressed and anxious as well, This really complicates it.
Well, it just makes it worse. That's right. And so,
and then if they put them on Tylenol besides.
Well, right. If you want the triple whammy, that's the way to do it. Yeah, because there was another study that was done that was published in the Journal of Developmental and Behavioral Pediatrics this year that looked at kids when the mothers had a lot of anxiety and depression. And they found that it increased the risk of emotional disruptive problems in these kids as early as 18 months of age. And it persisted right through adolescence. So again, how the mom is, and I suppose the dad too for sure, although they didn't look at that, has a profound effect on how well the kids are going to do.
Well, I think especially the mom, because most children spend more time with their moms.
Yeah, well, hopefully the mom is at home. But
the poor families, they're not going to be home.
We got a lot of latchkey kids.
Yeah, and then they've got babysitting problems and a lot of things to complicate it.
Exactly. So there's nothing like having a kid that's not being nurtured.
And they're probably eating fast food.
Sure. That's got a mom that is anxious and depressed, or maybe not even there, that has another role model taking care of them because they're latchkey. What do you think is going to happen? I mean, these are the kids that are growing up in the poverty sections of America, people like in the Iron Triangle in Richmond, California. I've got no chance of getting out of there compared to somebody who grows up in an affluent area like Berkeley.
It certainly ups their risk of getting into trouble. And like, you know, if they're really poor and they're having trouble affording to buy healthy food or food at all, think about that study that was done in jail that showed that when they just gave them one healthy meal a day or gave them a vitamin pill, that it reduced violence.
Yeah, by 44%. And it also increased the kids' IQs and how they did on STAR testing, which is of some importance. So there are a lot of factors that affect how well is a child going to develop. And, you know, if you're born in the wrong place at the wrong time, your chances of doing well and succeeding in society are far less than somebody who has that silver spoon in their mouth.
Somehow I was thinking about that movie, Mommy Dearest.
Oh,
what
boy.
A terrible mother she was. Talk about lack of nurturing. So it doesn't have to be because you're poor. It's just that that ups the risk for the problem.
Well, I think that's right. So either we're going to do, we should all be getting together and trying to set up programs in schools that take these kinds of things into account and really do something. It's sort of like the same thing that we don't do about people who are homeless on the streets. We step over them rather than walk with them.
Well, I think they have lunch programs for the poor, though, in the schools.
Well, they're doing some things, but we could do a lot more.
Yep.
I mean, a lot of the people that are on the street or people who are growing up in poverty areas are people from families where there's no opportunity. Maybe the father was a war vet and has PTSD, or the mother has no chance of doing much to have a job, so she's on the streets or taking drugs. What happens to the kids? I mean, you're just done. You have no chance. So these are things that a sophisticated culture that's advanced, that is trying to strengthen its weakest link, should be looking at. And it's simple, straightforward stuff. It's not something that's really complicated. If we can spend trillions of dollars in wars, why can't we spend a few billion dollars taking care of these areas where these kids are not being fed right and they're having all these stresses because their parents are under a great deal of stress? We just have to change. We have to evolve. If we don't, this is how it's going to be.
Well, and this is the time of year to do it. I'll tell you, we're already being flooded by requests in the mail. They send you return address labels and little things like that to encourage you to buy a meal for a poor family or a gift.
The problem with a lot of those programs is you can't trust where the money's going.
Might be just going to pay for the stamps.
Who knows? Well, it's somebody's. I mean, even a nonprofit pays salaries, and the amount of salary that's paid can certainly vary depending on who the person is and what they're trying to accomplish. We need programs at the state level, or the county level, or the national level,
and churches
to do something.
Churches too.
I mean, sure that you would think, rather than being wealthy, they should spend some of that money for these kinds of things.
We've all heard the expression to follow the crowd.
Yeah.
So when you eat out, do you really order what you want? Or do you go along with what others order from the menu? Well, this was kind of a fun study showing the power of peer pressure. So if you want to eat healthy at a restaurant, the conclusion was to eat with friends who make healthy food choices.
That's because we're so weak. Huh? That's right.
Well, especially if you have to say them out loud.
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, so what this boils down to is I'll have what he's having or what she's having because it makes you feel good to be like somebody else that's in the crowd.
Well, you know what's interesting? Well, for me, one of the things that I do is when we go out to dinner, if somebody else is paying, I want them to order first because I kind of want to know what price range we're in
or whatever,
you know. Or if you go out to dinner with somebody that's a vegetarian, and then I have a friend that I used to go out to lunch with once in a while, and she was vegetarian, and I never ordered meat because if I did, she'd say, going to eat that?
Right.
And when I was a kid, my dad used to make us eggs every morning for breakfast.
Uh-huh.
And so one morning, my friend across the street came over to walk to school with me. And she goes, ooh, you eat that? And my dad was so mad, he told her to go on ahead.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
Well, there are a lot of things that vary this. And there was a study at the University of Illinois, and again in October of 2013, that looked at that analyzed the receipts from a restaurant in Oklahoma that was a full-service restaurant. And what they did is they collected the receipts for about 3 months and from three different groups of people. People that ate a regular menu, people that ate a menu that had the calorie count on it, and the third group had a menu with a calorie count, but also with a traffic sign so that as you got to more calories, it would go from green to red. And it was really interesting because the people who were in that third group really did eat less in the way of calories because it was right there in their face, and they didn't want to be embarrassed, particularly if they're overweight, by ordering something that would make them look like a glutton.
Well, just think about it. When you go out to dinner, how many times has somebody that you're with said, how about splitting a dessert?
Oh, yeah, right.
Because everybody wants it, but they don't want to take responsibility for all the calories of eating the whole thing, you know?
Uh-huh.
So they kind of want somebody to share it with them.
Well, a lot of the time I've noticed when I go out with people who are obese or quite overweight, they don't order much. You know, it's not like they're fooling anybody because you have a look at them and you know what the story is. And I'm not judging that. That's
well,
not,
maybe
this
they
not
eat
meant
first.
To be that. Well, I don't know what they do, but it's the same kind of thing. You know, I'm not being prejudiced against people that are overweight at all. I'm just trying to look at the process.
But I've noticed that sometimes, too. It's like, how they didn't order very much.
No.
It just seems
And then they leave a little bit on their plate, and they may not even take a doggy bit.
But I think it also follows with drinks.
Uh-huh.
And how many courses?
Right. You're going to have wine?
Well, you're going to have appetizers or, you know, what you're going to do. So I think if you really want to order what you want, you should order first.
Yeah, probably so. It depends on how self-conscious you are, too.
Well, it's good to have healthy friends.
Well, it is. It may be better to go out with somebody that's overweight because, you know, maybe they're going to order small portions.
But that's not always true.
That's not always true. And then you may wind up having a five-course meal when all you really wanted was a little something.
You're going to the ice cream store afterwards.
Exactly. So the whole business of following suit when people set trends, we think we're so independent and how we manage our affairs in life. And let's face it, we're pretty much the same. We wear the same kinds of clothes. We drive the same kinds of cars.
Everybody wants to fit in.
Exactly.
Everybody's happier when they have similar choices.
Exactly. So it's really...
It's like, we have that in common.
Yeah.
We both like salmon.
Yeah, well, that's right. Every night, huh?
We both like chocolate mousse.
Yeah, well, everybody likes chocolate mousse. So it's really looking at how much is run from the inside and how much is run by what people... think about you from
I know,
the outside.
Like if I'm on a diet to lose weight, my friends don't like it.
Well, yeah. Look at you. I mean, you look fantastic.
Well, thank you. I just lost some weight.
Well, you did. But
my friends don't like me to lose weight, though.
Well, I'm your friend. I don't care if you lose weight or
no,
you,
yeah,
you don't.
Well, you're different. But girlfriends I'm talking about.
Yeah, well,
because they want to do it, too. They want to lose weight, but they don't want to do diet.
Well, the catty stuff, that's right. Well, a lot of it boils down to how strong are you? How self-confident are you? Do you need the support of people around you to do the things you do? Or can you really just do them on your own because you feel self-confident? It's an interesting thing to ponder. Anyway, we're at the end of the show again, so we want to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news and health the first and third Mondays of every month on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on drsaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. Do you get that? The videos are under the radio. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Take care. We'll see you next time.